D, the 14th. I have been here since Thursday evening, 3 days. As we rattled up to the tavern in the village, I perceived from the top of the coach, in the twilight, Theodore beneath the porch, scanning the vehicle with all his amiable disposition in his eyes. He has grown older, of course, in these 5 years, but less so than I had expected. He is one of those smooth, unwrinkled souls that keep their bodies fair and fresh. As tall as ever, moreover, and as lean and clean. How short and fat and dark and debauched he makes one feel. By nothing he says or means, of course, but merely by his old unconscious purity and simplicity. That slender straightness which makes him remind you of the spire of an English abbey. He greeted me with smiles and stares and alarming blushes. He assures me that he never would have known me, and that 5 years have altered me sehr. I asked him if it were for the better. He looked at me hard for a moment, with his eyes of blue, and then, for an answer, he blushed again. On my arrival, we agreed to walk over from the village. He dismissed his wagon with my luggage, and we went arm in arm through the dusk. The town is seated at the foot of certain mountains, whose names I have yet to learn, and at the head of a big sheet of water which, as yet, too, I know only as the lake. The road hitherward soon leaves the village and wanders in rural loveliness by the margin of this expanse. Sometimes the water is hidden by clumps of trees behind which we heard it lapping and gurgling in the darkness. Sometimes it stretches out from your feet in shining vagueness, as if it were tired of making all day a million little eyes at the great stupid hills. The walk from the tavern takes some half an hour, and in this interval Theodore make his position a little more clear. Mr. Sloane is a rich old widower. His age is 72, and as his health is thoroughly broken, it's practically even greater. And his fortune, Theodore characteristically doesn't know anything definite about that. It's probably about a million. He has lived much in Europe and in the great world. He has had adventures and passions and all that sort of thing, and now, in the evening of his days, like an old French diplomatist, he takes it into his head to write his memoirs. To this end, he has lured poor Theodore to his gruesome side to mend his pens for him. He has been a great scribbler, says Theodore, all his days, and he proposes to incorporate a large amount of promiscuous literary matter into these souvenirs intimes. Theodore's principal function seems to be to get him to leave things out. In fact, the poor youth seems troubled in conscience. His patron's lucubrations have taken the turn of many other memoirs, and have ceased to address themselves virginibus purisque. On the whole, he declares they are a very odd mixture, a medley of gold and tinsel, of bad taste and good sense. Page 4. I can readily understand it. The old man bores me, puzzles me, and amuses me. He was in waiting to receive me. We found him in his library, which, by the way, is simply the most delightful apartment that ever smoked a cigar in, a room arranged for a lifetime. At one end stands a great fireplace with a florid, fantastic mantelpiece in carved white marble, an importation, of course, and, as one may say, an interpolation. The groundwork of the house, the fixtures, being throughout plain, solid, and domestic. Over the mantel shelf is a large landscape, a fine Gainsborough, full of the complicated harmonies of an English summer. Beneath it stands a row of bronzes from the Renaissance and potteries of the Orient. Facing the door, as you enter, is an immense window set in a recess, with cushioned seats and large clear panes, stationed as it were at the very apex of the lake, which forms an almost perfect oval, and commanding a view of its whole extent. At the other end, Opposite the fireplace, the wall is studded from floor to ceiling with choice foreign paintings placed in relief against the orthodox crimson screen. Elsewhere the walls are covered with books, arranged neither in formal regularity nor quite helter-skelter, but in a sort of genial incongruity, which tells that sooner or later each volume feels sure of leaving the ranks and returning into different company. Mr. Sloane makes use of his books. His two passions, according to Theodore, are reading and talking, but to talk he must have a book in his hand. The charm of the room lies in the absence of certain pedantic tones, the browns, blacks, and greys, which distinguish most libraries. The apartment is of the feminine gender. There are half a dozen light colours scattered about, pink in the carpet, tender blue in the curtains, yellow in the chairs. The result is a general look of brightness and lightness. It expresses even a certain cynicism. You perceive the place to be the home not of a man of learning, but of a man of fancy. He rose from his chair, the man of fancy to greet me, the man of fact. As I looked at him in the lamplight, it seemed to me for the first 5 minutes that I had seldom seen an uglier little person. It took me 5 minutes to get that point of view. Then I began to admire. He is diminutive, or at best of my own moderate stature, and bent and contracted with his 70 years, lean and delicate, moreover, and very highly finished. He is curiously pale, with a kind of opaque yellow pallor. Literally, it's a magnificent yellow. His skin is of just the hue and apparent texture of some old, crumpled oriental scroll. I know a dozen painters who would give more than they have to arrive at the exact tone of his thick-veined, bloodless hands, his polished ivory knuckles. His eyes are circled with red, but in the battered little setting of their orbits they have the lustre of old sapphires. His nose, owing to the falling away of other portions of his face, has assumed a grotesque, unnatural prominence. It describes an immense arc, gleaming like a piece of parchment stretched on ivory. Page 5. He has, apparently, all his teeth, but has muffled his cranium in a dead black wig. Of course he's clean-shaven. In his dress he has a muffled, wadded look, and apparent aversion to linen, inasmuch as none is visible on his person. He seems neat enough, but not fastidious. At first, as I say, I fancied him monstrously ugly. But on further acquaintance I perceived that what I had taken for ugliness is nothing but the incomplete remains of remarkable good looks. The line of his features is pure. His nose, cateris paribus, would be extremely handsome. His eyes are the oldest eyes I ever saw, and yet they are wonderfully living. He has something remarkably insinuating. He offered his two hands as Theodore introduced me. I gave him my own, and he stood smiling at me like some quaint old image in ivory and ebony, scanning my face with a curiosity which he took no pains to conceal. "God bless me," he said at last, "how much you look like your father." I sat down, and for half an hour we talked of many things, of my journey, of my impressions of America, of my reminiscences of Europe, and by implication of my prospects. His voice is weak and cracked, but he makes it express everything. Mr. Sloane is not yet in his dotage. Oh, no. He nevertheless makes him out a poor creature. In reply to an inquiry of mine about his health, he favoured me with a long list of his infirmities, some of which are very trying, certainly, and assured me that he was quite finished. "I live out of mere curiosity," he said. "I have heard of people dying from the same motive." He looked at me a moment, as if to ascertain whether I were laughing at him, and then, after a pause, "Perhaps you don't know that I disbelieve in a future life," he remarked blandly. At these words, Theodore got up and walked to the fire. "Well, we shan't quarrel about that," said I. Theodore turned around, staring. "Do you mean that you agree with me?" the old man asked. "I certainly haven't come here to talk theology. Don't ask me to disbelieve, and I'll never ask you to believe." "Come," cried Mr. Sloane, rubbing his hands, "you'll not persuade me you are a Christian, like your friend Theodore there." "Like Theodore, assuredly not." And then somehow, I don't know why, at the thought of Theodore's Christianity, I burst into a laugh. "Excuse me, my dear fellow," I said, "you know, for the last 10 years I have lived in pagan lands." Page 6. "What do you call pagan?" asked Theodore, smiling. I saw the old man with his hands locked, eyeing me shrewdly and waiting for my answer. I hesitated a moment, and then I said, "Everything that makes life tolerable." Hereupon Mr. Sloane began to laugh till he coughed. Verily, I thought, if he lives for curiosity, he's easily satisfied. We went into dinner, and this repast showed me that some of his curiosity is culinary. I observed, by the way, that for a victim of neuralgia, dyspepsia, and 1,000 other ills, Mr. Sloane plies a most inconsequential knife and fork. Sauces and spices and condiments seemed to be the chief of his diet. After dinner, he dismissed us, in consideration of my natural desire to see my friend in private. Theodore has capital quarters, a dowdy bedroom, and a snug little salon. We talked till near midnight of ourselves, of each other, and of the author of the memoirs downstairs. That is, I spoke of myself, and Theodore listened, and then Theodore descanted upon Mr. Sloane, and I listened. His commerce with the old man has sharpened his wits. Sloane has taught him to observe and judge, and Theodore turns round, observes, and judges him. He has become quite the critic and analyst. There is something very pleasant in the discriminations of a conscientious mind, in which criticism is tempered by an angelic charity. Only it may easily end in acting on one's nerves. At midnight we repaired to the library to take leave of our host till the morrow, an attention which, under all circumstances, he rigidly exacts. As I gave him my hand, he held it again and looked at me as he had done on my arrival. "Bless my soul," he said at last, "how much you look like your mother." Tonight, at the end of my third day, I begin to feel decidedly at home. The fact is, I am remarkably comfortable. The house is pervaded by an indefinable, irresistible love of luxury and privacy. Mr. Frederick Sloane is a horribly corrupt old mortal. Already in his relaxing presence I have become heartily reconciled to do nothing. But with Theodore on one side, standing there like a tall interrogation point, I honestly believe I can defy Mr. Sloane on the other. The former asked me this morning, with visible solicitude in allusion to the bit of dialogue I have quoted above on matters of faith, whether I am really a materialist, whether I don't believe in something. I told him I would believe anything he liked. He looked at me a while in friendly sadness. "I hardly know whether you are not worse than Mr. Sloane," he said. But Theodore is, after all, in duty bound to give a man a long rope in these matters. His own rope is one of the longest. He reads Voltaire with Mr. Sloane and Emerson in his own room. Page 7. He is the stronger man of the two. He has the larger stomach. Mr. Sloane delights, of course, in Voltaire, but he can't read a line of Emerson. Theodore delights in Emerson and enjoys Voltaire, though he thinks him superficial. It appears that since we parted in Paris 5 years ago, his conscience has dwelt in many lands. C'est toute une histoire, which he tells very prettily. He left college determined to enter the church and came abroad, with his mind full of theology and Tübingen. He appears to have studied not wisely, but too well. instead of faith, full-armed and serene, there sprang from the labour of his brain a myriad sickly questions piping for answers. He went for a winter to Italy, where, I take it, he was not quite so much afflicted as he ought to have been at the sight of the beautiful spiritual repose that he had missed. It was after this that we spent those 3 months together in Brittany, the best spent month of my long residence in Europe. Theodore inoculated me, I think, with some of his seriousness, and I just touched him with my profanity, and we agreed together that there were a few good things left: health, friendship, a summer sky, and the lovely byways of an old French province. He came home, searched the scriptures once more, accepted a call, and made an attempt to respond to it. But the inner voice failed him. His outlook was cheerless enough. During his absence, his married sister, the elder one, had taken the other to live with her, relieving Theodore of the charge of contribution to her support. But suddenly, behold, the husband, the brother-in-law, dies, leaving a mere figment of property, and the two ladies with their two little girls are afloat in the wild world. Theodore finds himself at 26, without an income, without a profession, and with a family of 4 females to support. Well, in his quiet way he draws on his courage. The history of the 2 years that passed before he came to Mr. Sloane is really absolutely edifying. He rescued his sisters and nieces from the deep waters, placed them high and dry, established them somewhere in decent gentility, and then found at last that his strength had left him, had dropped dead like an overridden horse. In short, he had worked himself to the bone. It was now his sister's turn. They nursed him with all the added tenderness of gratitude for the past and terror of the future, and brought him safely through a grievous malady. Meanwhile, Mr. Sloane, having decided to treat himself to a private secretary, and suffered dreadful mischance in 3 successive experiments, had heard of Theodore's situation and his merits, had furthermore recognized in him the son of an early and intimate friend, and had finally offered him the very comfortable position he now occupies. There is a decided incongruity between Theodore as a man, as Theodore in fine, and the dear fellow as the intellectual agent, confident, complaisant, purveyor, pander, what you will, of a battered old cynic and dilettante, a worldling, if there ever was one. There seems at first sight a perfect want of agreement between his character and his function. One is gold and the other brass, or something very like it. But on reflection I can enter into it, his having, under the circumstance, accepted Mr. Sloane's offer and been content to do his duties. Page 8. Ce que c'est de nous. Theodore's contentment in such a case is a theme for the moralist, a better moralist than I. The best and purest mortals are an odd mixture, and in none of us does honesty exist on its own terms. Ideally, Theodore hasn't the smallest business dans cette galère. It offends my sense of propriety to find him here. I feel that I ought to notify him as a friend that he has knocked at the wrong door, and that he had better retreat before he is brought to the blush. However, I suppose he might as well be here as reading Emerson Evenings in the back parlour to those 2 very plain sisters, judging from their photographs. Practically, it hurts no one not to be too much of a prig. Poor Theodore was weak, depressed, out of work. Mr. Sloane offers him a lodging and a salary in return for, after all, merely a little tact. All he has to do is to read to the old man, lay down the book a while with his finger in the place and let him talk, take it up again, read another 12 pages and submit to another commentary. Then to write a 12 pages under his dictation, to suggest a word, polish off a period, or help him out with a complicated idea of a half-remembered fact. This is all, I say, and yet this is much. Theodore's apparent success proves it to be much, as well as the old man's satisfaction. It is a part he has to simulate. He has to make believe a little, a good deal. He has to put his pride in his pocket and send his conscience to the wash. He has to be accommodating, to listen and pretend and flatter, and he does it as well as many a worse man, does it far better than I. I might bully the old man, but I don't think I could humour him. After all, however, it is not a matter of comparative merit. In every son of woman there are two men, the practical man and the dreamer. We live for our dreams, but meanwhile we live by our wits. When the dreamer is a poet, the other fellow is an artist. Theodore, at bottom, is only a man of taste. If he were not destined to become a high priest among moralists, he might be a prince among connoisseurs. He plays his part, therefore, artistically, with spirit, with originality, with all his native refinement. How can Mr. Sloane fail to believe that he possesses a paragon? He is no such fool as not to appreciate a nature distinguée when it comes in his way. He confidentially assured me this morning that theatre has the most charming mind in the world, but that it's a pity he's so simple as not to suspect it. If he only doesn't ruin him with his flattery.